So welcome everybody to another talk here at Wachota One. And this title for this evening's talk is on, what is it? I think belief, faith and superstition. And it's because that many people have some really weird ideas and they have faith in the most unworthy of faith things. And they have superstitions and you wouldn't mind so much allowing people to believe in whatever they want to believe in, but sometimes it causes them all sorts of trouble, and their family trouble and society trouble. So in order to let go of the suffering of life and allow people to live more peaceful, happy, successful lives, it's good every now and again to talk about what you should have faith in and what's a stupid faith and what really is superstition and what is truth, and how you can find out the difference between the two. Thereby you can have a much happier, peaceful, more successful life. Because you see that these days that people have faith in all sorts of weird stuff, especially in places like Malaysia, where you always want to have good luck. And I see many, many people, they come to the temple and they shake some incense sticks. I remember one person coming up to me and he said, I don't know why I did this, but my mother did this and my grandmother did this and her grandmother did it, so it must be good. What are you doing that for? And even I don't know why you shake those incense sticks. They say it's good luck. Good luck for what? I say, good luck when we go into the casino tonight. And this is the first thing about superstition. Whatever good luck you have, whatever good luck you've managed to create in the last week or month or years, you'll lose it when you go into casino. Because I tell you, you don't need to be superstitious to know it's bad luck to walk through a door of a casino. Because people always lose. So maybe it's because that I was a scientist before I became a monk. Or maybe it's just because I come from forest tradition, where as monks we're always asked to question, to investigate. And it shouldn't really be just a forest tradition, because that's what the Buddha asked you to do. To not to believe, but to question. And not only when you find something which is worthy of acceptance, you've questioned, you've investigated, you've tested it out, only then accept it. Because otherwise you just become stupid. You just become like sheep, following what other people do. One of the monks grew up in my monastery in Australia, he was a son of a farmer. And you know that in Australia that most of the things they grow is not wheat or vegetables, but sheep. So he's a sheep farmer. And he said that one day he went out into the paddock, his father asked him to go and check on something, and he saw this whole circle of sheep. They were circling around this bush. The bush was so big and wide that they couldn't see the other side, but one sheep was following the one in front, and the one in front was following the one in front of it, and all around in one complete circle. And they went round and round and round and round. And if he hadn't taken one of those sheep out, they'd be still going round and round and round today. Because that's what sheep do. They just follow each other. Don't be a sheep. We are Buddhists. We are not sheep. So, always question and ask, what are we doing this for? So let's take one superstition. I'm just looking, how many of you got medallions on? Are they lucky? Are they going to help you? In our tradition they were saying, no, they don't help you at all. Even I remember reading in Australia, it hit the newspapers, even in Perth. There was a major general, and he was in the officers' mess one evening after dinner, and he was bragging about this medallion of the Buddha which he had bought in the market for over $500,000 US. That's how much it cost. Now some of these medallions are very, very, very expensive. And he said he bought this medallion for over $500,000 US because it was guaranteed to protect you from bullets. And he was in the army, and that's a real risk that someone might shoot you. So he said, now I don't have to worry about being shot by bullets because I have this $500,000 medallion. Now he was such a stupid general, maybe he was because he'd been drinking, that he told his junior officers, here, I'll prove it, here's my gun, shoot me. And the junior officer, he was given an order. And in the army, you've got to follow orders. So the junior officers took the revolver and shot the general. Dead. So much for that medallion. It didn't work at all. $500,000 and his life down the drain. So be careful. Those medallions, they say they work, but if ever somebody wishes to sell a medallion to save you from bullets, test it out first of all. Put it around the person selling it to you. Shoot them, and if they survive, then you can buy. But it doesn't work. You know, that happened once to my teacher, Ajahn Chah. He never gives out medallions. And if he heard that someone was printing medallions, he'd go there and confiscate them straight away, because you'd never give permission for medallions of his to be printed. However, the one day this guy came to his monastery and he said, look, I've been drafted in the Thai army. It's a dangerous profession. I need a little Buddha to put around my neck to protect me. And the Ajahn Chah said, that's a superstition. No, you can't do that. That's wrong. That's not Buddhism. And he said, listen, Ajahn Chah, said, I've given you so much dana, I've fed you so many breakfasts, I've given so many robes, so many donations. This is the first time I've asked anything from you. And you talk about gratitude, the first time I ask something, you won't give it to me. And so Ajahn says, okay, I'll make an exception in your case. I'll give you a Buddha to hang around your neck, which I guarantee will protect you from bullets. It's a big Buddha statue about 3 meters tall in the main hall. That I guarantee will protect you from bullets. And it's the only one which can. So please don't be so superstitious. How can a bit of metal protect you from bullets or protect you from harm in other ways? And that superstition can be very dangerous, because it means you're not taking care of your life. You think, I don't need to take care because now I've got a medallion. I don't need to wear a crash helmet, I've got a medallion. I don't need to worry about, you know, falling off the scaffold when I'm at work because I've got a medallion. And there's so many dead people with dead medallions, so be careful about this. I know this other superstition which almost killed me once. They have a superstition in Thailand, if you put the monk in the front seat of the bus, you won't get a head-on collision. Because, you know, monks, we've got good karma. So if we're in the front seat, it protects everybody behind us. And I remember, I think it's going from Chonburi to Bangkok. And as soon as I got on the bus, the driver, he didn't want to take any fare. He was so happy because he put me in the front seat. And the reason he was happy with me in the front seat, because there was a movie on the video screen. It was supposed to be for the passengers, but he was the one looking at it, driving down the road, looking at the movie, and I was supposed to protect the bus from collisions. Now that was really dangerous. Many, many times you had these trucks coming straight for us and I shouted, hey, truck coming. Oh, okay. I was very glad to get off that bus. Superstition almost killed me. But you know, sometimes I try to work with that superstition, especially putting monks in the front of vehicles so they don't have head-on collisions. I was traveling on Thai Airways once, and I told them, if you put me in the front, you won't have head-on collision. But they would not upgrade me to first class. No, 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 no. It was worth a try, though. So now that's a lot of superstition. But the thing which happens is, when you follow that superstition, it does mean you're not taking care. And that's a danger in it. And so obviously that I want you to have happy lives with no injuries, you know, no premature deaths. And so it's important that instead of having superstition, we understand the law of karma, we take responsibility. If you want to have good health, you have to eat well and exercise. And all the chanting and all the holy water and other stuff, does that really work? I know many people who've been blessed with holy water who died when they were 30. So does it really work? What it does do, the chanting, the medallions and everything else, they can give you like a boost, a little bit of inspiration. Because if you do have a medallion, it's just reminding you of the Buddha. So if ever you're thinking of doing something wrong, you look at the Buddha and think, can't do that. So please give your husbands a Buddha medallion. So whenever he's thinking, heaven mistress, he looks at that, the Buddha's with me, can't do it. Whenever you go to the shop and thinking of spending too much on your credit card, you look at the Buddha and say, no, can't do that. So what it does, it actually sometimes keeps you honest, it inspires you. Chanting and holy water, that might inspire you, but that's all it does. But I must admit, I do use holy water in Perth. Well, where I use holy water the best is in marriages, in marriage blessings. You know, marriage blessings are very spiritual things. There is a man and a woman deciding to live their life together, and it's difficult actually making it work. Sometimes it doesn't work. They need all the help they can get. And so sometimes I do the sprinkling of holy water. And I always give the bride a total soaking. The reason I do that, so I can actually dissolve all the makeup. And that way, the man can see who he's really marrying. It's very important in marriage to start with truth. So that poor lady, all her mascara and makeup is all dripping off. And now I can understand, why, is that what I'm really marrying? Oh my goodness. But it's also, if I do a holy water, I explain what it's all about. So it's not really a superstition anymore. So what I say is, it's a symbol. So in all religions, we do have symbols. And when we understand what the symbol means, then it actually can work. If it's just superstition, we're not quite sure why we're doing this, just my grandma did it, therefore I'm doing it. The holy water has four symbols to it. First of all, it's cool. Because you use water to cool yourself down. On a hot day, you love a shower. Over in Australia, you go for a swim in the pool or, you know, in the ocean to cool off. So number one, it's cool. So when I sprinkle holy water, say on a married couple or on you, I'm cooling you down. And I always leave them, after a marriage ceremony, I always leave them with a whole heap of holy water to take home with them. And I tell them, look, if she gets cranky, take some of the holy water and put it on her head to cool her down. If he starts getting really cranky, get the whole bucket and pour the whole lot of it to cool him down. Because that's what happens, and we get so hot sometimes. So emotional, so angry, so lusty, so desiring. We're hot-headed. So the holy water cools you down. And number two, like holy water is a symbol of purity. Because you use water to wash your clothes, to wash your plates, to wash yourselves. So when you have holy water, it's like cleaning you, getting rid of all the old rubbish from the past. As you can wash away the past to be clean and pure for the future. Now that's also a very wonderful symbol. Because, you know, we've all done bad things. We've always made mistakes and done stupid things. Like I said yesterday about the the encyclopedias which I sold, and I felt very guilty about that. There's always some stuff you've done which you'd rather not have done. And so having some holy water is like a cleansing, like a purification. So you don't have to carry the pain of the past. So also, if you've been really, really naughty, that's also when I give you soaking. So really wash all of that terrible stuff you've been doing in the past away. So at least you don't take it home with you. So it's a cleansing, a purification. And the next thing of holy water, it binds things together. Look, if you're making a cake or you're making some pastry, you get the flour, but you need water to bind it together. And in dry countries like Australia, when there's a drought, there's no water to hold the earth together, and the wind blows it all away, and it's erosion. So water is also the symbol of binding. In the commentarial tradition, that's what they call water, is like a binding element. So now we're living together in a family, in a society, in a community. We do need to bind each other together so that we can do far more together what we can ever do by ourselves. And that way that the water is a symbol, especially in a community, of binding people together to see if we can do things together rather than always going our separate ways. And lastly, and quite obviously, it's a symbol of growth and prosperity. Because without water there would be no sort of vegetables, no flowers, no fruits, no agriculture. And despite all of the industry of our modern world and the financial industry, we still need food to eat, and without water we'd be in big trouble. So it's a symbol of four things. Now, just to find out if you are paying attention, what are those four things? This is a test. What's the first thing?
Coolness.
The second?
Purity.
Yes, some of you got it wrong. Third thing?
Binding.
And fourth?
Growth.
Yes. So that's when I do holy water, I mind. That's what I'm doing. I'm giving you coolness, purity, harmony and growth. And by doing that, you're reminding people of their importance. And that means it's no longer a superstition. It's actually a teaching of the importance of these things. In a marriage, in an office, whatever you're doing, keep cool, don't lose your temper. If you lose your temper, you lose everything. So don't get hot. There was a case I read about in United States where someone lost their cool. It was a case of road rage. Do you have road rage in Malaysia? Well, these were two cars, I forget who did what wrong, but they were chasing each other, you know, through the streets of New York. And the person who was really, really angry was chasing this other car, who'd done something wrong, and he managed to catch up with his enemy, with a guy who'd done something wrong, at the red traffic lights, at a big intersection. So the two cars pulled adjacent to each other. And one of the guys was so mad, he jumped out of his car and he started banging on the window of the other car, trying to get in, trying to break the glass. And of course the driver, you know, inside the car was terrified what this guy would do, because he was so angry with road rage. He just totally lost it and was violent. And he was really lucky, before this guy could break the window of his car, the lights changed to green so he could speed off. And the other guy was trying to break into the car, turned around to get into his car and carry on chasing him, and saw his car speed off too. Because in New York, you don't leave the door of your car open with the keys in the ignition and the engine running. One of these street kids had noticed this, jumped into the car, stole it and drove away. And so this guy had lost his cool. He didn't only lose his cool, he lost his car as well. And that's what happens if you get angry. You lose things like your car when you jump out of it. So that's an example of just what happens if you lose your cool. So by encouraging people to keep cool in all circumstances, by remembering the holy water, by remembering the importance of purity. And that's when you do get married. You know why the girl wears white in a marriage? White is a symbol of purity. That's why women always wear these beautiful white dresses at a marriage. And you know why the guy wears black? Don't ask. But it reminds you, you should be pure, you know, in your vows and your promises towards one another. And of course, harmony is just so important. It's so hard to have harmony, isn't it? That's why somebody, that was actually, this was over in Sri Lanka. They told me, they said it was a Chinese story. Maybe you can tell me if it's true, it really is a Chinese fable, because I hadn't heard this before. There was a woman who came home from work and found outside of her house there were four old men sitting in the rain getting soaked. And so he said, come inside, come inside. He said, no, we can't come inside until, you know, your husband comes home. You know, we just can't go inside the house. So as soon as the husband and the kids came home, so the wife said, look, did you see those four men getting soaked outside? We should invite them in. So the husband came out and said, come in, guys. He said, no, no, you can't invite us in like this. You have to invite one of us in. And if you invite the right one, the other three will come in. It's a test for you. And the four men were called wealth, success, peace, and harmony. And so the husband went back in and said, these four guys outside, they're getting soaked. They're called wealth, success, peace, and harmony. And they told me, if I invite one in, the other three will come in. Now what I really want in my house is success, you know, for my whole family. So I want to invite success in. And the wife said, no, 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 look, I've struggled all my life to make ends meet. I want wealth. And the husband said, no, no, success. And the wife says, wealth. He said, success, wealth, success, wealth. And the daughter said, all I want is some peace. So let's invite peace into the house. And the husband, no, 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 it's a stupid idea. You know, I want sort of success. No, no, I want wealth. No, I want peace. And then the son said, look, all I want in my house is harmony. And the other one said, that's true. So they went outside to invite harmony in. And the old man Harmony came in and said, you made the right choice. Because when you invite harmony into your house, peace also comes. And with it, success and wealth. There's a lovely little simile. Have you heard that before? You have. Did I get it right? Very good. So that's why harmony is really important. We have to work together, otherwise we spend too much time arguing, just like governments all over the world, so they never get anything done. So it's important to have harmony. So the last thing about, obviously, prosperity and growth. Sometimes people think that a Buddhism, that we're not into sort of prosperity and growth. The Buddhism is all about letting go, renunciation, and living simple. No, as a Buddhist monk, I want you to be wealthy. Otherwise, I'll get no donations from my monastery. We're very practical as monks. So, yeah, be wealthy. But as long as it's wealth which is gained in a proper way. So that way that when we sprinkle holy water, we're actually encouraging people. Yeah, it's okay to be wealthy as long as you do it in the right way. But don't sacrifice harmony. And please just have coolness and also purity in your lives. And so the sprinkling of holy water becomes actually a Dharma teaching. And that's what all these rituals were. And if we don't understand it, it's a superstition and it's not a real sort of practice. Which is why that sometimes that in many religions we worship the wrong things. I was actually very disappointed in Thailand, in one of the monasteries I went to. I wanted actually to read the suttas. You know, these are the teachings of the Buddha, and they were locked in a cabinet, and I couldn't get the key. And they weren't there actually to read, they were supposed to bow to them. And I thought, that's not what these things are for. They're supposed to read the teachings. You're worshipping the wrong things. You should be worshipping what's inside, rather than just the things themselves. And I've seen that in many religions, this is the problem here, because I remember one of my stories was that many years ago, maybe about 6 or 7 years ago, there was headlines all over the world when I think the US Marines in Guantanamo Bay, they were accused of flushing a copy of the Holy Quran down the toilet. And all the people in the world were saying, this is just going too far. It's not respecting people's religions and faiths. But one of the journalists in Australia, he called me up and he said, I'm doing an article on this terrible event and I'm asking all the religious leaders I can find the same question. And now I'm asking you, Ajahn Brahm, as a leader of Buddhism in Australia. What would you do, Ajahn Brahm, if someone took a Buddhist holy book and flushed it down your toilet? What would you do? And I replied to the journalist, sir, if somebody took a Buddhist holy book and flushed it down my toilet, straight away, without any hesitation, I would call a plumber. See, we Buddhists are very, very practical. I know I'll have to use that toilet. And of course, that diffused the situation. I remember the journalist said, that's the best answer I've had all day. Thank you for making my day. But of course, that's being quite flippant. Okay, you can tell a joke, but then I got serious. Then I told him, I said, sir, you can flush as many holy books of Buddhism down the toilet as you want. You can blow up as many Buddha statues, like they did in Bamiyan. You can burn down as many Buddhist temples, you can even kill the monks and nuns. But I will never allow you to destroy Buddhism. I will never allow you to flush forgiveness, compassion and peace down my toilet. A book, yes. But the principles of Buddhism, no. And then I made a very wonderful, a very helpful observation. He said, you have to make a distinction between the container and the contents. The book is a container. You could destroy the container, but what's inside those books? What are the teachings of mercy, of love, compassion, forgiveness? Please understand the contents are the important thing. A Buddha statue, what is a Buddha statue? It is a symbol of a peaceful, compassionate, wise being who once lived 26 centuries ago in India. It's its contents. And so why are you going to go totally against what the Buddha taught by getting angry at someone who destroys the symbol of the Buddha? So understanding what these symbols mean, in other words, they are containers, and the message which they're supposed to be giving out is the contents. And it's the contents which we worship. Temples, we can always build new temples. But if we sacrifice forgiveness and peace and compassion, where is the Buddhism? It's gone. So understanding that, I said, you can destroy containers, but I'd always manage to keep the contents. And I'll tell people, whether it's holy water, whether it's Buddha statues, whether it's chanting, it's the contents which are important. The chanting, the rituals, they are containers. They are containers which are supposed to be ways of conveying to the people who are receiving them these beautiful teachings of forgiveness, peace, compassion, wisdom. That's what they're there for. So destroy the content container, but please keep the contents. And that was a great idea which was stimulated by the events when people try to destroy our symbols. When people try and make us upset and angry, I refuse to let other people make me angry. Because I say that my happiness is my concern. And, oh, there's a mug there. Another car. Yes, there's another car in trouble. So you may lose the container and the contents if you don't move this one. Here we go. The car, the lucky number, the lottery number today. You wait for it, exciting, isn't it? Do you all know the license number of your cars? Because some people don't. Anyway, the number is W. Is that you? You've got a car and a W? Here we go, the next, it's exciting. The next letter is L. Y. 8771 WLY 8771. The lucky winner is. They may be embarrassed. So WLY8771, please move your car, otherwise you'll be reincarnated as a bicycle. Make bad karma. So now, where was we? Oh, it's superstitions and stuff like that. You get like chanting. Many of you come and ask for blessings. And you ask for chanting. Why do you come and ask for blessings and chanting anyway? Does it work? No, remember this one occasion. Actually, I always know when the exams at school and university are on. Because just before examination time, we get all these young people coming to the temple, desperately asking for some chanting. You know, because you know what it's like? There's sometimes people that get, they should have been studying throughout the whole year. And when it gets to exam times, they realize it's really happening, only a couple of days to go, and they haven't done all the work. They come to the temple, and my goodness, they really ask some chanting, they do the incense stuff, they do everything, because they're desperate by that time. And I remember this one lady came to our temple to ask for some chanting. And we gave some chanting. I put a lot of effort into the chanting. It, you know, it takes a long time to learn all these chants in Pali. And so I really put my effort into giving her some nice chanting, and then she never came back again. But I knew what happened because her friends came and said, you know that lady you did all that good chanting for, you know, a couple of days ago, she's going around Perth saying the monks, Ajahn Brahm and his monks, are no good. But don't go to Serpentine Temple, those monks are no good. So why'd she say that? Because she failed. And she blamed me. It's my fault she failed. That's really unfair. I wasn't doing the exam, I did the chanting. You failed because you didn't do the work. And unfortunately people do that, they blame the monks because I did the chanting but grandma died. You know that happened once. And sometimes the chanting actually is powerful, it sometimes can work, it's not superstition. It really has some oomph behind it. And I remember going to the bed of somebody's grandma, and you know, they were about to die, and just basically the last bit of chanting, only maybe a few hours to go. So the family invited me over, rushed over there. And when I went into the room, you know, I did this chanting, and then I sort of left. And then they complained afterwards, because she got better. You know what it was? They managed to sort of convince themselves to let go of their grandma, and they were just prepared to let her die. They just wanted the child. He said, that was too strong, Ajahn Brahm. You know, we didn't want you to keep her alive. You wanted to give her a good death. You can't win as a monk. So when actually you do the chanting, I mean, what's it for? Obviously, you have to do your bit. You know, if you want some chanting, you know, for good luck, you have to work hard to make that luck sort of occur. You know, you have to study if you want to get a good result. So what the chanting does, it just gives you that little bit of extra boost, that bit of confidence, because most people when they do any examination or test or interview, we always have a lot of fear. And that fear saps our confidence, and because our confidence goes down, that's where we fail. So all the chanting is doing is actually, you know, strengthening your confidence and making you perform to your potential. It's actually making you do what you should have been able to do anyway if you were confident enough. So it's just like a morale boost. Sometimes I say the chanting which the monks do before an examination or an interview or an operation is pretty similar to what the supporters of Liverpool do in the stands. Come on Liverpool, come on the Reds, come on, or whatever other soccer team you follow. It's just that encouragement, that chanting really gives you a boost. And we know that works. So this is how the chanting works. It just gives you this morale boost. Yeah, it has some deeper power, but that's only if you get really good monks who know what they're chanting and actually have actualized some of the things they have chanted. They've got like the Angulimala chant, you know, for pregnant women. Now that was such a powerful chant when Angulimala did it. because it was saying that since my birth as an arahat, I have not destroyed any living being. By the power of that truth, may you have a painless birth. Now, because Angulimala was that serial killer and he changed, you know, because of the Buddha's teachings, and that's a very good story. There was someone who did so much bad, you know, killing so many people. You don't ask why, he caused an enormous amount of suffering. But he could let it go. He could actually forgive himself and let go of all the guilt and become totally enlightened and become a blessing to the world. If he could do that and let go of the pain of his own past, can't you let go of the pain of your past? How many serial killers have we got in this room or outside? Of course, not that bad. So you can forgive yourself. But anyway, because this was being said by a serial killer who'd just become fully enlightened, that had power. Any other monk that does that, it doesn't have the same power because it doesn't have the same meaning behind it. So sometimes the chants which are done really depends on the person doing those chanting. Sometimes they work as well. So it's almost those chants. Sometimes it's almost like getting the devas involved. Now, I don't know if you have faith in these unseen beings of ghosts and angels and devas. I never had faith in such things until being a monk, you know, you prove these things for yourself, that such things do exist. Now, the time when I got total faith in the existence of devas was when I was about 5 or 6 years as a monk. And that was a time when he used to go on these, he used to call it dutanga, wandering through the jungles and the lonely places of Thailand. You know, that was one of the most wonderful experiences of my life, because as this dutanga monk, you had to carry all your possessions with you, on your back. You weren't allowed to leave anything in the monastery for safekeeping. You weren't allowed to store anything. Everything you owned, you carried with you. And even before I left on this wandering tour, I didn't have very much. But after a few days, I cut that down to the barest minimum. And so you can imagine the sense of freedom, just walking along the roads of Thailand. Everything you owned on your back, just with no ties, with no burdens, with no appointments, and every crossroads I came to, I could go left, I could go right, I could go ahead, or I could turn around. It was total freedom. No burdens, no debts, no place I had to go, no place I had to flee from. It was like a bird. And I look back upon that time with just great nostalgia, just how free that was. But it was also quite hard, because you would go to a town for alms round in the morning, and because they didn't know you were coming, sometimes all you got was rice and maybe a banana. But it was enough to keep you going. At other times, you got quite thirsty, and this was one of those times. I was walking through the mountains of a range called Phupan, south of Sakonakon, and this was again about 31 years ago, when it was not developed, it was still just jungle. And as I was walking on these paths, I was hopeful that I would find like a stream or a well so I could fill up my water bottle. I'd run out of water quite some time back, and walking without any sign of a village, I was getting really, really thirsty. And when I came to the ridge of a hill, I saw in the valley was a small village of maybe 6 or 7 houses. But I did know from experience, even a small village like that, they would certainly have one house which was a general store, which will sell things like kerosene, cigarettes, matches, you know, just basics of life, including Pepsis. And I was thirsty and I was tired. I needed a boost. And at that time, when I was on top of that hill looking down, I remembered an old story of one of the great forest monks, Ajahn Chah, because he had gone to Burma during the Second World War. In those days, the monks would go anywhere. You could wander any place. You didn't need passports and visas and things like that. And so he was staying in Burma. But at that time, remember, Thailand was occupied by the Japanese, and the Thais now became the enemies of the British. And he was warned to leave that monastery as soon as possible, because even though he was a monk, he was Thai, and the British might think he was a spy and shoot him. It was dangerous, and he couldn't go the normal routes because he'd probably get arrested. So they sent him by the jungle paths to walk back to Thailand. Remember, this was 60, 70 years ago, and that was very rough terrain with hardly any people in that area. And apparently he told the story, he survived the trek, but he hadn't eaten for 3 or 4 days. He was so hungry that he was weak from the exertion, because those are very steep hills. He was so weak from exertion, he started to wonder whether he would make it, whether he would survive. And as he was walking, he remembered some of the stories from the ancient Buddhist texts, that sometimes these devas, these heavenly beings, sometimes they would intervene to help good monks. And he said, I'm a good monk. Now I keep my rules, I'm a meditator, I live very simply. And he said, if there are devas, they should help me. And that's what he thought. When a few minutes later, he turned a path in the middle of the jungle, in the border area between Burma and Thailand, and there was a man standing by the side of the path. He was standing there, very well dressed. Not the sort of dress you'd expect of someone living in the jungle, who usually wears rags. He was wearing, in the words of this monk, the clothes which a Bangkok gentleman would wear. Also, he was holding one of these tiffin cans, you know, with like 3 or 4 containers, like, you know, even I had this morning. And monks aren't allowed to ask for anything. So he was surprised that a man was standing there, but he started walking past when the gentleman mentioned the words Nimon Krap, which is the Thai words for making an invitation. So he stopped, and this gentleman in the middle of nowhere opened up the tiffin cans and put hot rice and delicious curry into the monk's bowl for lunch. It was hot food. It was the sort of food you'd expect from a gentleman in Bangkok, not like the monkey paws and yams you expect in the jungles. And this was so unexpected. Number one, what was a man doing standing there? How did he know a monk was coming? How did he have hot food? How was he dressed in such beautiful clothes when there wasn't a village in 2 or 3 days' walk on either side? So having filled the bowl with delicious food, the monk just broke one of our customs and he asked this man, where are you from? We're supposed to accept the food silently, but he couldn't help ask this stranger, where are you from? And this being in the middle of the jungle never spoke. He just with his finger pointed upwards. It was a deva who came to help a good monk. Now as I was standing on that hillside looking down at the village, I remembered that story and I thought, I'm a good monk. I'm a meditator, I keep my precepts. And I made a resolution. This is real, it's true. I said, if there are devas, please give me a Pepsi. needed it. You know, I was really thirsty and I needed a boost of energy. I'd been walking all day, hadn't had any water. So I walked down into that village. And very mindfully, not looking to the left or the right, because I wanted to test out these devas. And out the corner of my eye, I saw, you know, that one house, which was a general store. And I knew what to have inside of it, the usual things which all those general stores had. And I walked in front of it. No one stopped me. I walked past. And I thought, no devas. Maybe I'd gone about 5 meters past when I heard someone shout out, "Nimonkwa!" The words of making an offering. And I turned around and there was a woman with an open bottle of Pepsi for me. Now you may think that was a coincidence. And I'm sure the devas wanted to make sure that they made a very strong point this wasn't a coincidence, because 30 seconds later another man came out with another open bottle of Pepsi. That was number two. And then a third came out. And a fourth, and a fifth, and a sixth, and a seventh, and an eighth, and a ninth came out. And there was an old bench outside. I sat down and I lined up my 9 Pepsis in a line. And I think, because you may know in China, what's the lucky number? No, that's 8. 8 is in Chinese. In Thai, 9 is the lucky number. Was it Thai? It's a Thai mark there. Gao means Gao Na. So 9 is a lucky number. So those Thai devas, they wanted to make sure once and for all that I understood, yes, they do exist. And I saw those 9 bottles of Pepsi and said, "Thank you, devas." They obviously exist. But you can't ask for those things, you know, if you're not a good person. So superstition, sometimes we ask for things when we don't really deserve them. And that's a problem. However, if you really are deserving, then these things actually happen. The other time when I asked the devas for some help was one of the most amazing experiences of my life in Perth. I'm telling you all the supernatural stories now. This is not super, this is real, this happened, many people were there and saw this. That our Buddhist society in Australia is not that old. I think it was formed, I think in maybe 1963 or something, no, 1973, when the first people met together in a small house to form our Buddhist Society of Western Australia. We've made huge strides since, one of the really, really big successful Buddhist communities. But our president of our committee, one year, reminded me that we were soon to have our 30th anniversary. And we'd made such great progress, he said that we should do something to celebrate our 30 years. And he was suggesting doing an open-air ceremony in a small park to the south of Perth. Now many of you know that I was born in August. I'm a rabbit, a Leo. And Leo rabbits always want to do things big. So I said, let's go big time. Let's show the people in Perth that Buddhism has arrived. So I said that let's hire the field in the very center of Perth, the Supreme Court Gardens, if it's available. Because that year, Waisak Day, the full moon day, happened to fall on a Sunday. A day off when if we held a ceremony, people would be able to come. And it was our 30th anniversary. And so we all decided, yes, let's go big time, let's go for broke. So we managed to hire the Supreme Court Gardens fields. We managed to get a beautiful Buddha statue delivered from Thailand just beforehand to celebrate our 30th anniversary. We managed to invite the Premier of Western Australia. He was the head politician of the state. And lots of dignitaries. A Thai ambassador came as well. And we put thousands of dollars, you know, into the arrangements. We worked so hard, an organizing committee, trying to get everything just right. When I woke up that morning, it was pouring down with rain. So we check the weather forecast. Is the rain going to fade away that evening? And the weather forecast said, no, it's going to get worse. There was a storm coming, and it was going to hit Perth about 8 p.m., exactly the time we were going to do the circumambulation around the shrine. And as we went into town, you could see the heavens were all black. A storm was coming to hit Perth. It never stopped raining all morning and afternoon. Nevertheless, we worked out in the open, getting soaking wet. We didn't mind. This was for the Buddha. And three times, because this was the head politician in Western Australia, three times his office called me. Are you calling it off? No, I said the first time. Second time, look, we've checked the forecast itself. There's going to be a violent storm hitting just that time. Are you calling off? No. Third time, no way, we're going ahead. One of my monks, because it's not just me, it's a whole sangha of many monks, they said, Ajahn Brahm, can I have a word, please? I went aside and said, Ajahn Brahm, I respect you. You're my teacher, but you've gone too far. You're going to make an idiot out of all of us. Look, it's a storm coming. You can't do this. It's not going to work. Be rational. Call it off. No. Another man came. He was a retired sailor. He spent all his life on a merchant sea boats. He came up to me and said, look, Ajahn Brahm, look, you're making an idiot out of yourself. Now, I've been at sea, I've seen the barometer. The pressure is going down, down, down. That can only mean one thing, a violent storm. I know this, was my livelihood at sea. You have to call it off. No. So I did some very, very heavy chanting. I did. And of course, you understand what happened. Just about half an hour before the ceremony, it stopped raining. Quarter of an hour before the ceremony, I'll never forget this Burmese woman. She came running into a tent with tears streaming down her face. Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Brahm, you've got to come out, you've got to see this. And I went out the tent, and she pointed up into the sky. The clouds had separated, and you could see the Waisak full moon, brilliant and bright in the night sky. From that moment on, it was inspirational. There was a TV crew filming, and this Australian TV commentator kept on saying, this is weird. This is weird. This is weird. And the premier came, and we did our ceremony. And when the ceremony was finished, rain, heavy rain, all night. That field flooded under 2 inches of water. The freeway flooded as well. I've never known it since or before to be flooded. That was a storm, but it stopped for an hour and a half for our ceremony on Waisak, 30th anniversary. The Thai ambassador was very, very impressed. It was her who called up the king and made sure we got Royal Katina every year as a result of that. The premier, still, he was in Cambodia. He's retired now. He was in Cambodia doing some teaching. Sent me a nice Christmas greeting recently. The power of chanting worked. Not many people came that evening because they were to the east, to the west, to the north and south. They couldn't believe we had a ceremony, because where they were, the rain pelted down all evening, and trees were uprooted and branches came down. But where we were, it was dry and clear. We did our ceremony. That's a true story. I haven't exaggerated it. The chanting sometimes does work. If you have a very, very important event. If you are, if you are just having a party, a karaoke party for Christmas, no way, it won't work, it's going to rain. If it's for something really important, yeah, these devas, they do help, they do. So this is not superstition, this actually works, and it's there, it's true. But you have to be a good person. So all of this superstitious business, sometimes that you have to understand what is really worth having faith in and what is really just you push aside, as that's just mumbo jumbo, doesn't really make sense at all. One of the things I wanted to bring up, especially over here, especially amongst Chinese people, is fortune tellers. How many of you go to fortune tellers? Hopefully none of you. Because if you go to fortune teller, you are the dumbest of the dumb. If you do go to a fortune teller, please check how wealthy they are first of all. Because if your fortune teller is poor, how on earth can they tell your fortune when they can't tell their own? Never trust a poor fortune teller. But people love having their fortunes told. And a lot of times it's a waste of money. And sometimes they go to monks to get their fortune told. That's bad karma on both sides. Good monks don't tell fortunes, and I'll tell you why. This is another of Ajahn Chah's stories. Because again, this one guy came to Ajahn Chah and said, Ajahn Chah, can you please read the lines on my palm and tell me my future? And Ajahn Chah said, good monks don't do that. And he said, but I bet you can do that. I don't care if I can do that or can't do that, we don't do that. And then that man also said, remember that sermon you gave on gratitude? And I've helped you out so much. I'm one of your chief lay supporters. Like many of you, you've helped me out. You've given donations to my Jhana Grove project. You know, you pick me up from the airport. You feed me every day. You give me cups of tea. You look after me. And then you ask me, can you tell me my fortune? I say, no, that's not gratitude, is it? So Ajahn Chah said, okay, I'll make an exception. Just for you. And this was the one and only time in Ajahn Chah's life he read the lines on someone's hand. He took the man's hand and said, look, I've never done this to anyone else, but I'll do it for you. And remember, because I'm Ajahn Chah, I don't make mistakes. What I tell you is guaranteed to be true. Because great monks can do such things. So you can imagine how excited this man was. He had total faith in Ajahn Chah, and he knew that soon his future would become clear. And Ajahn Chah, you know, he was very meticulous, you know, mindful. He traced the lines with his finger very slowly. And as he was concentrating, you know, on the trajectory of the lines, every now and again he would stop and look and go, hmm. Or sometimes, uh-oh. We can imagine how this man felt when Ajahn Chah was finding out his future with hmm or uh-oh. He was getting so uptight and so he couldn't wait until Ajahn Chah was finished. And it took about 5 minutes for Ajahn Chah to finish, and that was like an eternity to this man. Imagine it was you having your hand read by an expert, by a holy monk. And he finally finished. And the man said, yes, 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 what's my future going to be? And Ajahn Chah very slowly said, sir, I've just read the lines. Yeah, I know, get on with it. And I never make mistakes. Yes, I know you don't. What's my future going to be? And Ajahn Chah looked him in the eye and said, "Sir, having read your palm, your future is uncertain." And Ajahn Chah wasn't wrong. Now that is a great monk, because what he was doing, he was taking away all the superstition by giving him an exercise of winding him up, saying all his oohs and ahs just to sort of to play around with him, and then hitting him with the Dhamma in a way he would never forget, because the future is uncertain, yes. So if you want your future told, come and see me and I'll tell you your future. Now that's a powerful teaching, because it means that your future is not all mapped out for you. You can actually change your future, go in a different direction. Your future is totally free in your hands. You can make anything, and I really mean that, anything. You can make so much happiness, success, bliss, whatever you want, or you can make a misery for yourself, because your future is uncertain. It's up to you what you make out of what you've got. And I know that. I've seen it many times. People in the enormous difficulty, having a really difficult time, in such inner pain and turmoil, their life totally a mess. And they get in there and they work hard. They let go of the pain of the past. They really learn from their mistakes. They grow, and my goodness, they make such an amazing job of their lives. Look at that great man, Steve Jobs. You know he's a Buddhist, Steve Jobs. Now what he did, you know, he founded Apple Computing, and then personal computing, they got in there first of all, and then IBM came in and they started making personal computers, and so Apple lost its market share. So they needed to change direction. They needed to get rid of these old guys who were very good at the very beginning, what they thought was stopping progress. So who did they sack? Steve Jobs. This was a company he founded, and he got the sack, thrown out on the dust heap of life about 28. No future. He had money, but nothing to do with it. So there he was, 28, a failure, sacked from the company he started. He said he was depressed for 1 week, but that's all. Good Buddhist, you get over it, you let it go. And then he thought, what do I enjoy doing? He let go of the past, started looking at the future. And it was always IT. You know, he loved IT. Not just to make money, it was just his passion, what he really enjoyed doing. So in the next couple of weeks, he started two more companies. One, I think, was called Excel. And it was another IT company, which in a couple of years got so successful, another multi-million dollar company, that Apple Macintosh took it over. He got bought out by the company that sacked him, on the condition that he got reinstated on the board. And the other company he founded at that time was even more famous. This is a second company. He already founded Apple Computing. No, not Apple Macintosh, or the Mac. And the other company he founded when he was down and out was called Pixar. You know, behind Toy Story. So here's a guy who forms one multi-million company, is kicked out on his backside, and does he get negative and depressed? No, he just starts another multi-billion dollar company. Now that's a guy, I think, makes a really good Buddhist. So you've been kicked out from your marriage, you've lost your job, you've got a cancer, you've got your kid has died in a tragedy. What do you do? Your future is totally uncertain. It does not mean that your future has to be painful and suffering. That is superstition. Faith, belief in the possibilities of life, means that you can be down and out and turn it around totally and make a wonderful life for the rest of the years you have. It's totally up to you. That's the meaning of that prediction of Ajahn Chah. Your future is uncertain. That means you can do anything with it. Just need a bit of advice, a bit of encouragement, a bit of chanting and holy water. And you can do whatever you want. So, unfortunately, I've already, it's amazing just to keep on going, and it was an hour and 10 minutes have gone past. So I better stop there for what I've said so far on faith and superstition and how we can make use of these things without just getting lost in them, how we know the difference between the container and the contents of Buddhism, and how we can use some of these old traditions in wise ways rather than in stupid ways, and how when we look at predictions to the future, you can't tell the future, it's totally uncertain, which means you are free to make anything you want of your life and that of your family. Thank you for listening. Okay, we've got some questions, and if you see here that we've got these pieces of paper over here, so if you want to come and ask a question about the talk, and you're either staying here or, oh my goodness, or you're coming from outside, you can always write a question down, but please, one question per person, not these 1, 2, 3, 4. Ajahn, kindly enlighten the Buddhist belief on the origins of the world, universe and life. That's an easy question. The origin of the universe is to be found within you. You are the creator of the universe. And that's the saying of the Buddha. Brilliant saying. Instead of thinking, this universe, where did this universe come from? I remember I was a theoretical physicist. Between 13 and 14,000 million years ago, there was a Big Bang. It doesn't need to come from anywhere because this is a zero-sum universe. The amount of energy or mass energy in this universe is zero. The positive component of mass energy and the negative component of mass energy look like they're balancing out to zero. So it can come literally out of nothing. A negative component of energy, a positive component of energy, creating this universe at the Big Bang, you can get nothing out of nothing, because this universe is nothing. It completely balances the positive energy and the negative energy. In Buddhism, sunyata, emptiness, nothing. And this is not the first universe. If one universe can begin, why not many? You know, before China thought it was the Middle Earth, the center of the whole universe, and then it discovered many other countries. England thought it was the center of the universe. Now the United States thinks it's the center of everything. Poor old Australia, it's down under, on the edge of the universe. They don't like that. But anyway, you know, they've got maps. They've got maps in Australia, where they put Australia in the very center. It's upside down as it usually see it, because now we're up top in the center of things. But anyway, that's just because Australians being Australians. But Professor Carl Epstein of UCLA, many years ago, his particular theory, which I think is the most accepted, was that this is one universe of many. It's not the first universe which has been built. Just like China is not the center of the universe, planet Earth is not the center of the universe, the Milky Way is not the center of the whole universe. We're not the center of anything. So why should this be the one and only universe? There's been many more. Even universes get reincarnated. So a whole series, this is what the Buddha said, unending series of universe. It happens because it can happen. So the universe happens according to one of the basic laws of science, Murphy's Law. If it can happen, it does happen. How do I convince a person who is not a Buddhist not to consume alcohol? He said it is to de-stress from a hard day's work. He also likes the taste of wine. It's very easy, you know that story I said last time, because if it's a Chinese person, they're afraid of ghosts. And if they're afraid of ghosts, you've got to tell them about the most dangerous ghost in the world, not a superstition, but a real ghost. I've seen it many, many times, the bottle ghost. Tell them to be aware of the bottle ghost, because it's very, very virulent at Christmas time. It makes people, it possesses people. And it makes people talk in very strange ways. And it makes people a possessive people. They can't even walk in a straight line. And they act totally out of character. And if they drive a car, it can kill them. The bottle ghost. It lives in bottles of wine and beer and whiskey. It's a bottle ghost. That's why we call these things spirits. So tell them every time you uncork that bottle of wine or unscrew the bottle of Johnny Walker, the bottle ghost is going to go into you and kill you. Dear Ajahn, we are told that Ajahn Chah attained arahat. What are the special qualities you're able to notice in him? Okay, one of the most inspiring qualities in Ajahn Chah I saw at the very end of my time in Thailand. He would always sit underneath his hut to talk about Dhamma, to answer questions, receive guests. And upstairs where he lived, there's only his attendant would actually go up there. And I'd never been up to see where he lived until maybe the last months before I went to Australia, just before he had his stroke and couldn't speak anymore. He asked me to go up to his room and collect something for him. This was the first time I went into his personal quarters. Now by that time he was a very, very famous monk. The Queen of Thailand had been to see him, generals, very wealthy people had come and given big donations and lots of things. When I went into his room, it was empty. He had a mat, you know, one of these grass mats, a wooden pillow, a spare robe, you know, on the line, and that was it. Nothing else. When I saw just his personal quarters and how empty they were, with no possessions, I realized that that was a real monk. That's actually how you find out a monk, by how they live, how much they have. If they've got heaps and heaps and heaps of stuff, they're attached. They have possessions, which who wants possessions anyway? So it's a great way you can find out. Go to their personal quarters. See how they live. And that was so impressive, because I sometimes was very disappointed with monks. You know, they had so much stuff, TVs, radios. You know, there's a TV in my room up here? I looked at it the other day. I stood in front of it, but I didn't turn it on, and I saw my image. That's the best way to look at a TV. Look at it without turning it on, and then the glass screen, you can see the reflection of who you really are. Yeah, I was on TV. But don't turn it on. What is the meaning of attaining arahat? Does the arahats have any physical discomfort, diseases, etc.? We are reading the Buddha too was suffering from ailments from time to time. Please tell us about the arahathood state. Well, when you're an arahat, you still can get sick, you still get die, you still feel pain, but you don't have the mental pain. So you just accept it. It's just pain, that's all. Big deal. What the heck? So the mental pain. So you don't get afraid, you don't go crying and screaming, oh, why me? It shouldn't be me. Why did I get this? So, but anyway, you try and find out. You become an arahat and then you'll know. My understanding is even arahats have to undergo all these desirable and undesirable elements, but they wouldn't get elated or get depressed about the conditions. Exactly. Very good. I have a Christian friend who believes that the world is coming to its end. I had thought that this is utter nonsense, so I do not directly tell her that. She showed me testimonies of people who had been sent to heaven and hell and back to earth by God so that these people could explain to the world that heaven and hell truly exist. She also demonstrated her ability to pray in God's language, which neither she nor I understands. No one understands. It's gobbledygook. It's madness. It's crazy. I'd like to know what is the explanation to such phenomena. Thank you very much. Okay, number one, the world is coming to an end. Look, tell that woman who believes the world is coming to an end, tell her, are you really sure the world is coming to an end? And if she says yes, are you really, really sure? And if she says really sure, then say, well, let's prove it. I will bet you $10,000. I will put it with a lawyer. You put $10,000 with a lawyer. And if the world comes to an end in 2012, you win. If it doesn't come to an end, I'll take the 20,000. You can't lose, can you? If the world comes to an end, there's no money anyway. But they never do that because underneath they know that it's just gobbledygook. So people have been saying that, you know, in 1000, if you read history, actually before that, because I was a Christian, I went to Christian schools, Jesus said the world will come to an end before my disciples have finished trekking all over Israel, all over Palestine. He was predicting an end of the world in their lifetime. And they believed that, and of course it never ended.
In 1000 AD, because 1000 they thought, many people in Europe thought the world was coming to an end. And they left their villages and went into the hills and mountains to await the end of the world. It never happened. In 1999, I think Nostradamus thought the world was going to come to an end. And then everybody was waiting for the end of the world. It didn't happen. Next year we had Y2K, and it didn't happen. Now we have 2012, the movie, and I guarantee it didn't happen. People lie. You know, they love to worry themselves. But Buddhists are wise. You can say that, I bet you if the world doesn't end after 2000, forget about the money. If you really think the world's going to end, and it doesn't end in 2012, in the 1st of January 2013, will you become a Buddhist, please? People say they're going down to heaven and hell. Most of them are crazy people. So, they are crazy people. And talking in tongues. I can walk my book over. 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 I can walk my Any crazy person could do that. So don't disbelieve all that craziness. I mean, that really is. There is Christianity, which is very good and I respect it. But this sort of stuff, that's crazy stuff. So please use, you know, your sort of reason. And tell her to use your reason. Please be evidence-based. Sort of all that sort of stuff does not work. Ajaba, my mother passed away 50 years ago, but I have had several times dreamed of her dying in the dreams. This has upset me. What do you think this meant and what must I do? Okay, 50 years ago, she's sure to be reborn by now, so if you dream of her dying, it's just the trauma of the death, something you haven't really dealt with. Just accept it, make peace with it, let it go, and you won't dream of it ever again. So it's not your mum trying to contact you. Years ago, she's gone now. So all it is just that memory which has become a bit obsessive. So just let it go. If you really want to, you can make a donation to a temple or do some dana, but not just for her, because she's probably gone now, she can't receive it. This is just for you, so that you can actually let that pass go. Ajahn, how can I calm my mind while it is overwhelmed by emotions? I find it almost impossible to meditate or focus while being driven away by emotions at times. There's nothing wrong with emotions as long as they're positive emotions. So keep the bliss, keep the inspiration, keep the compassion. I'm a very passionate monk. A compassionate monk. So keep the positive emotions and negative emotions like anger and fear and guilt and blame. Those are the ones we try and let go of. So keep the positive ones, especially inspiration. So your emotional person, great. Take the positive emotions, be inspired. Look, you're in a temple. You know, you're doing a retreat. You're with a reasonably good monk. And you're in a human birth. Be inspired. You're doing something really, really wonderful. This is great. I'm actually following in the footsteps of a Buddha. This is brilliant. So get inspiration rolling. And then that will actually be a positive emotion, which will swamp all the negative emotions. So work on your emotions, especially the positive ones. There were one or two times of meditation I can feel my limbs disappeared, and the breath also seemed to disappear, but not sure why I wasn't able to sustain it. Actually, can you give me some suggestions? Yeah, when they disappeared, good riddance. Now, your body is such a pain. You always have to sort of scratch your ear and scratch your nose and move your blanket and move your mouth. I'm just move your hair again. I'm just noticing when people move your toes, your feet, and move your head. I'm just describing what I'm seeing in front of you happening. Scratch your forehead rather than back over there, and hold your neck and get up to go to the toilet and scratch your nose. That's you. Why do you always have to do this? Because your body is always demanding of attention. It never lets you still for a moment. You have to move your hand now. Now, have you noticed this, how you got so used to this body that you don't notice just how much attention it seeks every moment? So when your body starts to disappear, it's just so wonderful. I don't have to scratch anymore. I don't have to move. I don't have to do anything. My body's gone. Whoopee. It's felt that this terrible, terrible, demanding kid has gone to sleep and you're free at last. That's what it's like when your body disappears. So if you really appreciate the body disappear, then you get afraid that it would last. So appreciate it, don't be afraid. I've learned both Anapanasati and Vipassana, and it seems that I'm better at Anapanasati, since we don't know when we're going to die. Should I focus on just one method, Anapanasati, until I get something like jhana, put aside my Vipassana practice, until I achieve something? But there's no difference between Vipassana and Samatha and anything else. That's why that sometimes in my monastery, I usually teach breath meditation first of all. If they can't do breath meditation and they have difficulty with it, then I teach them Anapanasati. And if they can't do Anapanasati, then I teach them Vipassana. And if they find Vipassana difficult, then I teach them insight meditation. If they can't do insight meditation, then I teach them loving kindness. If they can't do loving kindness meditation, then I teach them metta. If they can't do metta, I teach them letting go. If they can't do letting go, then I teach them Anapanasati again. It's exactly the same thing. So, you know, we give them different names. It's just a trick. That's the thing, you're doing something different. You can't do it one way, you do it another way. But it's exactly the same practice. So, there's no difference there at all. It's all about letting go. I often find myself in a disconnect after a trip when I return to normal worldly life. And daily living, I can't put aside thinking and just meditate. When I'm disturbed, I need to understand why I deal with it. How do we continue to practice meditation while working and living a worldly life? You can never get as deep as you get in a retreat, but in your worldly life you need to take some breaks from now and again. This is what I say to people when I give seminars to CEOs in big companies and their managers, because they get so stressed out. Do you get stressed out at work? Why do you get stressed out at work? This was in the interview I gave on TV a little while ago. How heavy is my cup? After 1 minute, it really starts to feel heavy, and my arm aches. After 5 minutes, I'm in pain. After 10 minutes, I'm in agony and a very stupid monk. What should I do when it starts to get really heavy? Don't throw it away, just put it down. I put it down for 30 seconds. I relax and I rest, and my arm relaxes. And after 30 seconds, when I pick it up again, it feels lighter. Try it yourself, it works. It feels lighter because you rested your arm. It's exactly the same weight, but because you rested, it's easier to bear. What is stress? Stress has nothing to do with how much responsibility you have in your life. If you're a CEO, a mother, or just a monk, it doesn't matter what you do in your life. Stress is all about when it gets too heavy, you don't know how to put it down. And that's why you get stressed out. So when life is too heavy, when your business or your concerns or your responsibilities really bear on you and are too heavy to hold, let it go. Learn your meditation, let go, put things down. Only for a short time, 5 minutes. And then when you pick up your burden again, it's much lighter. And the rest of the work you do, you'll be far more productive and efficient. The trouble with modern business, they think that the more time you spend on the job, the more you'll get done. And they don't look at efficiency. You put aside the work for 10 or 15 minutes and meditate. Yes, 15 minutes you've lost. for you made that up very quickly with greater efficiency, higher quality work in shorter periods of time, because you've rested and your mind is not stressed. I told that in Colombo a couple of weeks ago. It was a big mistake to say that in Colombo, because now I've got all these invitations to teach at businesses in Sri Lanka and I'm already too busy. But I let it go. In metta meditation, can an inanimate object be the object in meditation? Yes, you can do metta towards your breath. Can it be anything the meditator has affection for, such as seedlings, trees in the forest, the lake, the ocean, the sky, even an imagined landscape, so long as it gives happy thoughts and inspiration? Yes, you can give metta to anything. There was a young German man who came to visit me in my monastery in Perth and spent about 6 months there over a year ago. And he told me this very fascinating story about the power of metta. He was, before he came, he was a student at a university somewhere in Germany. And his first day on campus, he happened to pass the ATM machine. And the ATM machine emitted a gurgle, that's how he said, some really weird sound. And he interpreted that as the ATM being friendly with him. And as a result, he always would give metta to the ATM machine whenever he would pass it. Have a great day, ATM. May everything go well for you. May you be very full of cash and people never swear at you when their account is not full enough to get any money. And he was always very kind to this ATM machine. And he said one day he was having his lunch just on a bench close to the ATM. No one had been to that ATM machine since the time he sat down, maybe 10 or 15 minutes ago. And as he was having his lunch, he heard the gurgle again. So he turned around to look at the ATM, and a 20-euro note came out. And he couldn't believe it, because no one had been close to the ATM for 10 or 15 minutes. They went up to the ATM, he took out the note, waved it around. Does this belong to anybody? No one claimed it, so he put it in his pocket. That's the result of metta. The ATM looks after you. And you look after it. And that's a true story. So if any of you are short of cash, you can feel suffering. It works for him anyway. Can the Buddha be an object of metta meditation as well? Of course, everything can. For a beginner, if one is doing metta and super meditations, how do one reconcile the two since they're opposite of each other? How can one say good, peaceful thoughts in an instance and have those things for one's body in the next? God, this is just balancing. You know, if you are thirsty, you have water. If you're hungry, you have food. So, you know, if you've got lots and lots of lust, you do a bit of a super. But don't go overboard with a super. Don't go looking, you're all yucky, and I'm terrible, yucky. People go too far in negativity. So a lot of times a super meditation is not very good for people already depressed. Just send you over the edge. So, metta is the one to go for. Do more metta. You can't go wrong with metta. The more metta, the better. Even ATMs will make you richer. So put aside a super for the time being. Do lots of metta. If I don't like social activities, mingling and talking to others much and giving money seems rather a lazy effort, what should I do to cultivate dharma? Meditation is one of the highest dharmas you can possibly do. Cultivate your mind, because it has such a beautiful effect on other people. Remember all the other people who have to put up with you. So if you're a nice person, you don't create so much suffering to the people in your office, the people who drive down the road. When you're driving down, you have so much metta. You stop the car, please come in front of me. Please, you want to turn right in front of me, please come into my lane. My lane is open to all sentient cars. So, you're a much easier person to live with when you have metta, so it's great doing metta. So you're doing meditation for the sake of all sentient beings. It's the greatest act of dharma you can give. So it's a great thing to do. If I don't like other superstition, I don't have one. Number one, do you believe in Feng Shui? Yes, it's one of my disciples over in Perth. He had trouble with his wife. The relationship was just really on the rocks. He was thinking of separation. He tried marriage counselling, nothing worked. Tried a psychologist, that didn't work. So as a last resort, he went to a Feng Shui master. And he told the problem was the furniture was the major problem. So I asked him a week afterwards, did it work? He said it worked perfectly. When his wife was out shopping, he rearranged the furniture against the door so she can't come back in. I am very happy. That's a Feng Shui joke. But yeah, Feng Shui does have an effect, but it's only a minor effect. Many other things are more important. So yeah, it has an effect. But you know, your kindness, your wisdom, that is more powerful than any Feng Shui. It's a Feng Shui of your mind. That's what we do here. So rearrange the furniture of your mind. Take away all the bad passions, the ill will, the guilt, so take that out and replace it, rearrange it with beautiful metta and forgiveness and peace and kindness. That's a Feng Shui of the mind, which is what I work on. What is the best way to persuade a stubborn person? Well, it's easy, just use the negative psychology business. So if you, again, a stubborn person, this works with, I wanted this woman to become our president for 1 year because she was a very powerful businesswoman and she's a great organizer in my Buddhist society in Western Australia. Now, it really needed someone who had some business experience to take it to the next level. So I went up to her one day and said, look, you know, we really need you as president. And she came up and said, look, I can't do it. My business is taking off. I need to spend more time on my business. I'm building a new home, I'm going to look after my family, I just haven't got the time. And I thought very quickly, I said, oh, well, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have asked you. Look, I know that you're a really good person, you probably feel guilty about this. When you go home afterwards, you can't actually, you know, help me when I've helped you so much. So look, I don't want you to even think about this anymore. Look, just to make it quite clear, I ban you from even thinking about becoming president. You can't do it, okay? 3 days later, she wrote me, what do you mean I'm banned from being president? And she became the president. And she admits, that's Rachel Green. She admits, I totally controlled her. I really got into her head with psychology, which she should have known better, but I really got in there. And I made her president by banning her. Now, I'm really sneaky. You know, my psychology, because when you know how the mind works, it's amazing what you get away with. You know, as a monk, you know how to work people. Be careful about me. So a stubborn people, you can work with a very easy. Oh, these are actually pretty ones. How's the time going? Oh, it's 20, I've got plenty of time. What is the difference between faith and confidence? Like, faith is like a belief without really any evidence to it. Confidence is actually usually a faith which is supported by evidence. So you're confident because, you know, you tried it out and it works. In other words, you've got evidence to support it. But a lot of faith has got no evidence at all. Just like, you know, that speaking in tongues business. I mean, what evidence is that any language at all? If somebody could speak in tongues and speak Pali, because I know Pali, and they sort of, in a church, they started saying like, "Itipi sarvaka arahang sama sapu." I'd be impressed. I'm not impressed at all. So it has to have some evidence there. That's one of the great things about Buddhism. Yeah, you know, you had faith in things like devas, but you didn't really know if they existed or not until you had some personal experience, and then you got confidence that they do exist. So it's the evidence. So you can start with a faith, but remember that faith is uncertain. You can believe in the wrong things, and many people do. Test it out and be honest, for goodness sake. Don't just believe it because a book says it or because everyone else says it. Test it out and try it out. And that's one of the great things about Buddhism. It really works. It's sensible. The scientists agree with it. many of my friends I went to Cambridge with, they're scientists and they're Buddhists. Why? It is because it is, according to science, there's no contradiction between science and Buddhism. With other beliefs, there certainly is huge contradictions. Faith is very important in Christianity and Islam. In Buddhism, we talk of sadhana. What is the definition or meaning of sadhana? And how important is sadhana in Buddhism? Again, sadhana is like faith, but you have to be very careful with faith because there's so many different people teach different types of Buddhism. What are you going to have faith in? In all the different types of Buddhas, all the different monks who come and teach you, not just Ajahn Brahm, which ones are you going to believe in? Because they all say different things. So, use your wisdom as well. Test it out. Question. And look, if I don't give you a good answer, reject me. So this is one of the things which I remember once going to a lecture and someone asked this brilliant question and the speaker just refused to answer it or just answered it in a smarter way which didn't really address the question. I thought that was really being dishonest. So once I heard that, from being in the audience, I made this statement to you. If any question you ask, if I don't give a good answer, please come back to me and say, Ajahn Brahm, you never answered a question. Because I think if you have the courage to actually ask a question, I must try my best to give a decent answer. If I don't give a decent answer, sometimes I look at you and I see that, no, that's not what you're asking. I ask you, please ask again. Because I respect questioning that much. Because that's the only way we can test faith and turn it into wisdom. Unfortunately, when the sort of Christianity I grew up, you weren't allowed to ask questions. You ask the question and say, no, just believe. Made no sense to me. Okay, that thing answers that one. Wow, I think this is all the same person. Gee, you've been thinking too much. In Christianity and Islam, they have prayers. In Buddhism, we have chanting. What is the difference between prayers and chanting? In prayers, you're asking for something for yourself, usually, or maybe something for others. May I marry that beautiful girl I fall in love with? May she fall in love with me back? And chanting is really to inspire you. Like we do the chanting in the morning here. It's great teachings of Buddhism if you understand what it means, which is one of the reasons why we translate into English. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness, the medicine, to say, can this understand what you're talking about? And there it is, may all beings be happy and well. It's not, may I be rich and win the lotto and get the promotion. So you find that chanting is far more selfless. And prayers, in many religions, are very selfish. They're really desires and cravings. That's a great difference. Some Chinese believe that it's perfectly okay to listen to chanting in the temple, for example, chanting at Amitabha in the temple, but we should not listen to the chanting in the house as it attracts ghosts and spirits as they like to listen to it. Well, that means you should never invite the monks to your house for a dana because they will chant in your house and they'll leave the ghosts there. That really is superstition. Chanting invites the nice spirits and they protect you afterwards. So it's great if you have great chanting in the temple, then it keeps the ghosts and spirits outside and just the heavenly beings they like to come, the really nice beings. They like to hear it, they want to protect you so they can hear it tomorrow, not just today. So that's a very good thing to do, chanting in your house. It's much better than listening to rock music. In Malaysia, in funeral services, the monk conduct the chanting services in Pali language, and as a result, I observe the family members, relatives, and friends of the party one are at a loss and do not know the significance or meaning of the services. Can such chanting be done in English? Of course they could. It's very nice to do it in English. If you do it in a Pali or in Chinese, sometimes it has a nice tone which is very relaxing to people, which is great. That inspires you and you're used to it. It relaxes you and inspires you. Wonderful. But in English, it might be even better. Can Ajahn share your experience in conducting funeral services that makes it meaningful? The best part of modern funeral services is actually when we do eulogies. And eulogies is where we say something about the person's life. And you may notice that whoever that person is, you always say the wonderful things you've known about that person. At the eulogies, you remember the happy times you've had together. And any bad things you've had during the time of that person's life, you really let go of. You don't talk about that. It's a great time of forgiveness. So at funeral services I perform, I always do a forgiveness ceremony. So you may be able to introduce this. Whoever is conducting the ceremony says, on behalf of the departed person, if there's anything they have done by body, speech or mind, intentional or unintentional, or things they didn't do they should have done which may have offended anyone in this ceremony, on their behalf I ask forgiveness. And you say, whoever owns the car BKA5333, you should ask forgiveness because you're obviously blocking somebody. BKA5333, please move your car, otherwise it might get cremated. But anyway, so the forgiveness ceremonies are very beautiful. So whoever's conducting it, say, I'm conducting it, on behalf of the departed, I ask forgiveness. On their behalf to all the people in the audience, all the family and friends. And then I ask all the family and friends to ask forgiveness of the departed. If there's anything you have done, by body, speech and mind, which have hurt or caused irritation and pain to the person who's now died, please ask forgiveness. The things you should have done which you failed to do, ask forgiveness the one in their casket. On their behalf, I give you that forgiveness. It's one of the most beautiful ceremonies, which means at the time of the passing away of death, at the funeral service, all the pain, all the hurt, all the negative experience of our life, we deal with forgiveness. So we only carry forward into our life the beautiful times we've had together. The painful stuff we deal with the forgiveness of. That makes it very, very meaningful. Chinese people believe the departed one will return within 3 days after his death. What's Buddhist view on this? It's uncertain. They don't return within 3 days. Sometimes in a couple of hours they're back. Sometimes they don't come back at all. So I don't just evidence base. How many of you have seen a ghost? We have them. Seen a ghost? None of you. We had them. How many of you have heard a ghost? Quite a few people have heard a ghost. Some of the majority of you haven't. So what happened to your relations? What happened to them? They didn't come back. It's very, very rare to see a ghost, but you can. But it's less rare to hear them or to smell them. But remember, these are your relations, your loved ones. If they come back, they come back just to help you, to look after you, that's all.
That's a lucky number.
Lucky number. Well, you know that story. I've got time to tell that story. I think I told it last time, with the tsunami ghost. No, okay, this is a true story. This was just after the Boxing Day tsunami a few years ago. And this was actually in the town of Gubi, just in southern Thailand. There was this Thai woman who was married to an Englishman. In the middle of the night, she had this dream. Maybe, as I'm telling this story, the person's next to the lights, could you please dim the lights? Okay. What about the back? Can you give the back lights as well? Let's make it really so happy. Here we go. Yeah.
In the middle of the night, you can't even see, you can hear. In the middle of the night, 2 days after the tsunami, this Thai girl had a dream. The dream was of this person comes to her. She was a Western girl, blonde, but her hair was a mess. Her body was all cut and gashed, and she she came up to this woman in the dream, she said, "Help me. Help me. Help me. I'm dead." She said, "I was on Phi Island when the big wave hit. I'm dead." She said, "Help me. My phone is in the bottom of the ocean. But right now, my mother in London is trying to call me. Please help me. Also right now, Thai soldiers are picking up my body and putting it in a temple on Phuket Island. Please help me. I want a funeral, a Buddhist funeral service. This is my name. This is the temple. I want you to call my mum. Tell her, don't come now. I don't want her to see me like this. Do the funeral service and tell her to come to pick up the ashes. This is her phone number." And after giving the number, the Thai girl woke up. She remembered everything. The name of this person, the temple in Phuket, and the phone number. It was one of those dreams which was so clear that she woke up her husband and told him everything. And her husband recognized that that was an legitimate London phone number. So she told her, his wife, "Ring it up." She said, "No way, you ring it." So he rang the number. It was the middle of the night in Thailand, just late evening in England. The woman picked up that phone. After a brief conversation, it was the mother of the girl so named, who had been worried about her daughter, who was on holiday in Thailand. The mother, she knew something had happened to her daughter. It wasn't such a surprise that she was dead. But now she knew for certain. She cried, thanked that couple, and gave permission to do the service. And after the cremation, she would come to pick up the ashes. The following morning, they drove to Phuket, found that temple. Because it was chaos, they had permission to go inside. And when they looked at the bodies, exactly as she had seen in the dream, there was a corpse laid out. They could identify her name. And because the Thai soldiers were trying desperately to get rid of the bodies before they rotted, they gave permission for them to do the cremation. When the cremation was over, they collected the ashes. The mother arrived from Heathrow at Phuket Airport. They embraced, cried, said thank you. They handed over the ashes. They had done their job. And then they went back to Krabi. That night, she had another dream. This time, the ghost which came in the dream had beautiful hair, as if she'd been to Samod. Her clothes were white and radiant. Her face was like she'd been to a spa. She was smiling and said, "Look what you've done for me. Look how beautiful I am now. I'm a deva. Thank you so much for what you've done and looking after my mother. I've come to say thank you. And here are some more numbers." This is true story. She remembered everything in that dream too. And of course that was not a telephone number. It was a lottery number. And it won. And they made a lot of money. The moral of that story is, next time you hear a ghost, don't send it away yet until you ask for money. Okay, go for lunch again.
That's a true story, tsunami ghosts. So they made a lot of money on that. So don't be afraid of ghosts. But if you do see a ghost and it does win, remember you got the story from me, so 10%. Okay. Whether in Western or ancient societies, the belief in ghosts and spirits is there. We heard of personal encounters with ghosts and also stories from forest monks and Buddhism. We have a repetitive. Can Ajahn share your experience on this from Buddhist perspective and how to handle it if one comes across ghosts? I think we've already mentioned that. Asking for a lottery number. If they don't give a lottery number, then take them to go. I remember one of your talks you mentioned of a case of a near-death experience where a patient found himself in a heaven-like place and fed a being who asked him what things he had done on earth, whether he's judging people, etc. Then the being told the patient his time is not up and had to go back next moment the patient's awake. Doesn't this sound similar to the Chinese and, to my understanding, also some Christian belief that if some beings at heaven's gate with a book to record and judge you? What is Buddhism's view on NDE and such beliefs as of heaven by the Chinese? Is Buddhism also taught on heavenly realms? That's a billion question, but yeah, this is what happens when you die. You float out of your body. Again, you can go to that nimitta that light I told you about. But first of all, you have what the Buddha called the Manamaya Kaya, the mind-made body. In other words, you can see, you can hear, but not with your eyes, with your mind. Which means you can float up and you can see things which your eyes never see. There was a classic case of near-death experiences where one person operating table in a hospital in the United States, they floated up above their body, and now the operating theatre had these very high windows. So, you know, just to give some light, but so you can't see through a sort of human level, you know, maybe about sort of 3 or 4 meters up off the ground. And when they floated up, they saw a tennis shoe on the ledge by the window. And when they came back again, they said, yeah, we had this floating experience, and we saw a tennis shoe on the ledge. They said, that's ridiculous. How could a tennis shoe get up on the ledge in an operating theatre? And of course, no one, you know, who was walking or standing in that room could actually see it. You had to actually be high up ready to see it. So they decided to test it out, and of course, when they got up on the ladder, they saw a tennis shoe up there. And that was a classic case of tennis shoe example, where a person saw something that shouldn't have been up there, which no one else knew was there, actually was there. So it's actually proof that these are not sort of imaginations, these are real experiences, you hear and see real things. So yes, this is what happens, and you sometimes go through the light. And if you meet someone, that is no one else other than your own conscience. You know, just like in this life, no one judges you except yourself. Which is why, if you come and listen to talks like this, or talks about forgiveness coming soon, if you learn how to forgive yourself, then you won't judge yourself. You will forgive yourself. This is one of the important things I do here. It doesn't matter what you've done wrong in your life. It doesn't matter how bad or cruel or wrong you've been. You can forgive anything. So please, you forgive yourself. Let go of the pain of your own past, what you have done. And then you will never send yourself into a lower room. You will never want to punish yourself. Instead, you will learn from your experiences, dig in the dung, and you'll be a garden. So you never need to go to lower realms ever again. That's one of the meanings of being a streamliner. The lower realms, you can't go there anymore. Because you know how to forgive. No one else judges you, only yourself. Okay, this last question from the thing with... Another one, I keep coming up. Okay, never mind. Here we go. Met my neighbour every day, 5:30 a.m. in gym. He died young, tragically. That's what happens when you go to the gym. Now, if you go to the gym, you don't go to the gym, you know, you die anyway. He died young, tragically. 1 month ago, nearby our area. After learning about his death, I'm afraid to go to the gym. Fearing I might be seeing him there. What should I do? We see him there at 5:30. Lottery number. Which line? So please go there. Which gym is it? I'm going to go there and ask the lottery number. Now, look. When I was a student at Cambridge, I joined 3 societies. One was the Buddhist Society, which was, you know, the beginning of my journey into Buddhism. The second was the Astronomical Society, because I just love astronomy. And the third was the Psychic Research Society, where we looked after ghosts and did all sorts of weird experiments on psychic phenomena. And at that place I met many of my lifelong friends. Now, one of those friends that was in the, I think was the president of the Psychic Research Society, was also a Buddhist, and now he's a professor of physics at London University. He's a lifelong friend. We shared many, many common interests. And also at that time, I met the, he was a don at one of the lecturers at university, who was the head of the Psychic Research Society in Cambridge at that time. He later went on to be the head ghost hunter of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. Officially, he would have this wonderful business card, Dr. Tony Cornell, head ghost hunter of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And every now and again, even in Australia, in the Sunday papers, there may be an article about ghosts in UK. He would be the one writing it. So I saw many times, you know, his name at the bottom of the article. He was the expert, and he was a very close personal friend. The last time I was in England, I had lunch with his wife, but unfortunately he was too sick to come. That was only about a year and a half ago. So he's a very close personal friend, and when he retired, he told me, he said, he'd seen many, 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 many ghosts in his career. He said that the frustrating thing, he could see them, and they were throwing things around the room, and he had all this incredibly expensive equipment, infrared cameras, you name it, he had it. But they could never get, you know, the defining photograph. You know, you could never find out why. But, you know, everyone could see the ghosts, but when they developed the film, it wasn't there. So frustrating. But anyway, he said that throughout all of the research they've done on ghosts, real scientists, not sort of weirdos, these are real people with their heads screwed on the right way. He said never once has a ghost ever harmed anybody. All they can do is make you scared. But he said, again, he doesn't know why, but this is like a law which has been confirmed by over 100 years of observations. Ghosts can make you scared, but they can't harm you. He said, it's really strange, but things go flying through the air. They always miss you, but they never hit you. The ghosts are such good shots. They always miss on purpose. And it's really weird. So that means he's never afraid when he's close to a haunting. So he knows, you know, he can't be hurt or harmed. All the ghosts do is make you scared. And once you get used to this, you know that, you know, you're not scared anymore. My own personal experience with ghosts is that they are far more scared of you than you are of them. Especially monks. Because we're so powerful that they're terrified of us. So if you see a ghost as a man, you feel so much compassion, like it's a tiger, you're a tiger, and they're sort of a human being, they run away, because you're powerful. And, you know, as a man can really hurt and harm a ghost, not the other way around. That's why, as I say, monks are great ghostbusters, because with a mic around, the ghost gets terrified, not the other way around. So remember that, the ghost can't help you. Often the ghost can help you, especially if it's a ghost of a loved one. You know, sometimes they protect you. Sometimes a burglar is coming in your house, they wake you up. Or sometimes it's a fire, and they wake you up. So don't underestimate sort of the love of ghosts if you look after them. So don't need to be afraid. Last question here. We witnessed the death of an old lady who was climbing a hill with us in the jungle early morning. We charted her departure until a rescue team came to pronounce her dead, died of a heart attack or shortage of breath. Moments later, many small birds came over singing loudly from above the tree's branches. These birds were not all afraid of the crowds. Are these birds dangerous? This happened many, many times, that sometimes the birds or animals, sometimes they sense that something amazing has happened, like a death. And they come around to sort of celebrate rather than to mourn. Never underestimate the intelligence of animals. So I think there was, probably wasn't David's, but that was actually just birds celebrating just the departure of some beautiful being. These birds seem to be, there we go, I just turned around. This bird seemed to be celebrating her good deeds and her death. After 10 minutes singing, they flew off before we brought her body down the foot of the hill. We know her personally as a very calm person without any anger. By chanting, help her leave this world in peace, she climbed higher than younger persons, determined lady. Thank you, Ajahn. Yeah, that's probably what happened. There's a little fly thing you see. She told me this lovely seminar she went to with a Tibetan nun. And it's nice to start telling this story because at this, did I tell this story yet? I'm not sure. But anyway, at this seminar, the nun split the group into two, and they paired off, one from one group, one from the other group. The first group, they had to pretend to die. And the second group had to pretend to look after them. So I think when she rang the gong, so that the person pretending to die fell on the floor, clutching their chest, and the other person was supposed to be helping them, trying to do CPR, trying to sort of get them away, whatever it was. And then afterwards, they did a debriefing. And when you died, what was it like? And the person said, it was just so disturbing. The person was interfering with the peaceful dying process I wanted to go through. As they were trying desperately hard to keep me alive. And that was the whole point of the seminar. When you die, you want to die peacefully. And it's a very important part of your journey, the death moment. If other people are frantically trying to keep you alive, pushing your chest up and down, putting their smelly mouth over your mouth, please brush your teeth before you go. Then at this last moment of your life, which you want to go very peacefully and mindful, gets disturbed. So this brilliant nun, I don't know who it was, she reversed the roles. And now, when the roles were reversed, after they had that experience, the next time that someone died, the other person let them go more peacefully. They didn't try so desperately to keep someone alive. In our modern societies, we are so afraid of death that we'll keep people alive at all costs, even making their last moments very uncomfortable. So please, if you're with someone who's dying, respect them enough to let them go peacefully. Don't interfere by trying desperately to keep them alive when it's not worthwhile. Just as I would like to die peacefully, I would want you getting all agitated and panicking. Ajahn Mom's dying, he can't die. Come on, push my chest up and down, break my clothes, and push the gloves. So please, don't be afraid of death so you can let your loved ones die peacefully. So that he did that. He did some chanting, which is good, but not too loud, softly. The person may be disturbed, but maybe getting to chant, they heard this all this terrible chanting. So did it softly. And then just let them go. Okay, so thank you for those questions. Now, is there any questions from the floor before we finish off today? No, great, because I'm tired. Okay, well thanks for listening today for that talk on the superstition, belief and faith. The last I've seen is as ghosts, and so we do a transference of merits, which we're going to do right now, the ego thing.